upside down on the table that I really understand, that I don't want them to call. No news, it's true, is good news. The cocktail waitress arrives, expertly balancing a tray with our four Singapore slings. Gin concoctions the color of a tropical sunset, topped with a pineapple wedge, two maraschino cherries, and a paper umbrella. Before we can even take our first sip, I look at the waitress and exclaim, "Four more slings!" Like I'm at a presidential re-election rally, clamoring for another term. Meredith starts to protest, but I cut her off. "It's either that or a penis whistle, and I tell everyone on the barge that you're getting married tomorrow." Meredith nods her understanding, then confirms my order with the server. "Another round, please." The server smiles at my sister with sympathy and whispers, "Congratulations." As we drink our first slings, we grill Meredith about the wedding. Who proposed, when, and why elope? We do our best to make her the center of attention. While she's not consumed with bridehood, it is still her occasion. Her day, and not mine. "Remember when you were six and got your head stuck in the back slats of a park bench, and Mom freaked out and called the fire department?" "What?" Jeffrey asks. "You never heard this? Turns out she could just crawl out the way she crawled in, but for some reason refused until two firemen pulled her out screaming."
"Why firemen?" Jeffrey asks. "Where was your father?"
"Working," I say. "He was always working." Meredith smiles and turns the color of her drink.
"What made you think of that?"
"I don't know what made me think of that."
"Are you stuck?"
The words are out of my mouth before I can stop them.
"What? What does that even mean?"
"I don't know," I whisper.
"Pregnant?"
Meredith nearly chokes on her drink.
"I'm stuck here with you drinking this, which is like grain alcohol or something. I had better not be pregnant."
"Oh, relax," I say. And Meredith kicks me under the table, hard, like we used to do when we were kids and ordered by our parents to be quiet. I scrunch my face at her, signaling that she will get hers in return, and she laughs again. Aaron and Jeffrey ask something about her dress.
"What about Franklin being Chinese?"
I blurt.
"What about it?"
"I don't know." I'm trying to stay involved, pull my thoughts away from Lily, to be in the moment. "What about kids? Does it change anything about how you will raise them?"
"Of course not. It mostly means I can never wear heels."
Meredith has always been self-conscious about her height. As we drink our second slings, we press Aaron about single gay life in San Francisco and remain tuned to his every word like he's a telenovela. His stories are outlandish and addicting, and we understand most of what's going on, even if the concepts are a little foreign for the rest of us in longer-term relationships.
"You mean people just do that in the streets?"
Jeffrey interrupts when Aaron is in the middle of a story about the Folsom Street Fair. "What do you mean, naked?" I add. "Naked, naked?"
"What are chaps?"
Poor Meredith. By the third round of slings, we know what we're doing. We dispense with the pineapple and the cherries and the umbrellas and get down to the business of gin. Two rainstorms have showered the lagoon, and we're due for a third. And the band on the barge has paddled by us several times, playing what they bill as top 40 hits, but which are certainly not the current top 40 hits, unless Kool and the Gang have made some recent cultural resurgence I'm not aware of. Some straight couples dance on the barge, but I'm not sure how they boarded, or if they're even supposed to be there. The conversation turns to Lily, and Meredith and Aaron ask questions, and I let Jeffrey answer as I lower my head to my glass and chew on my straw. After a few minutes, my straw mangled beyond any ability to do its job, I finally speak. When Lily was a year old, she ate an entire bag of wasabi peas. I laugh at the ridiculousness of that sentence, but no one else does. She'd once eaten a bag of chocolate-covered blueberries that someone had given me as a gift, so I had been down this road before. Since chocolate is toxic for dogs, I called the vet, and they suggested giving her some hydrogen peroxide as a way to induce vomiting, 1 teaspoon for every 10 pounds of body weight. So, 1.5 teaspoons for Lily. Pretty effective stuff. To this day, I don't know if wasabi peas are toxic to dogs, but to be on the safe side, I decided to pull out the old hydrogen peroxide. Only this time, she was wise to the trick and wanted no part of it. So I grabbed her by the snout and pried open her jaw. At the last second, she zigged left, and I zagged right, and the peroxide ended up going down the wrong pipe. So not only did she not throw up, but now in addition to wasabi peas burning her stomach, she had hydrogen peroxide burning her windpipe, and she couldn't breathe without a horrible wheezing sound. I rushed her to the animal clinic, and a few hours later, it was as if the whole thing hadn't happened, but I remember thinking I was going to lose her. I remember how much I hated myself that night, how I felt like a total failure if I couldn't keep her alive for more than a year. Somewhere in my speech, the rain over the lagoon had started again, and the patter of rain on water sounds like a gentle snare drum. I pause and take the disfigured straw out of my glass and replace it with another straw from an empty glass. I don't even know whose empty it was, nor do I care. I don't know what made me think of that. But I do know. I hate myself again, much as I did that night. Living things, maybe not barnacles or plants, although plants technically do bend their leaves toward the sun, need to move. And under my watch, Lily was unable to retain what she was born with, the ability to move herself about. Even if it was an accident, or an injury that was breed-specific, just one of those things, it was my fault. Just as every unpleasant thing that happened to her was a failure of mine to keep her safe. On the table, hidden behind a standing cocktail menu, is a bowl of snack mix. I stick my finger in it and swirl the crunchy items around, taking a sort of inventory to see if there are any wasabi peas. There aren't. Ow! The kick comes swiftly under the table, and I jump, and the cocktail glasses rattle. I look across at Meredith, who is grinning broadly. Enough with the self-pity. You're in trouble now, I say to Meredith. What did I do? She says, feigning innocence while failing to stifle laughter. I grab as many of them as I can by the elbows and pull them away from the table. Let's dance. The rain stops, and the barge sets sail again, this time with us aboard, and I'm already waving my hands in the air doing some sort of rhythmic snapping thing when the band starts to play You Make My Dreams by Hall & Oates. The Vow. I'm not entirely sure what Franklin's Chinese parents think of their son marrying a tall white woman. But I'm pretty sure what they don't think the occasion needs is 2 6-foot-plus homosexuals. Still, they nod and smile and do their best to make polite conversation. And the judge who officiates turns out to be Chinese, and that seems to go a long way toward making the whole thing more palatable. San Francisco City Hall is a stunning feat of marble, ambition, and architectural chutzpah, a Beaux-Arts monument to government as beautiful as any cathedral. After Meredith and Franklin get their marriage license, we wait in the cavernous entryway at the base of the grand staircase for their turn to get hitched. The floor's marble inlay consists of circles and squares, and I trace them awkwardly with my foot. Meredith looks stunning in a simple cream-colored backless wedding dress from J. Crew. It's perfect for both her body and her temperament. My sister is not someone whose wedding I ever imagined. She's not the kind of girl who grew up daydreaming of one, or playing bride in any fashion. But now that I see her looking radiant in this backless cream number against the ornate but not ostentatious backdrop of City Hall, I can't imagine it any other way. When it's their turn, we climb the grand marble staircase, Meredith and Franklin first, Jeffrey and me and Franklin's parents silently behind them. I look up at the dome. It's supposedly the fifth largest in the world, and it's a marvel to behold. At the top of the stairs, we stand in a rotunda in front of two double doors. Behind them are the mayor's offices, where San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and supervisor and gay rights pioneer Harvey Milk were assassinated by a former colleague in 1978. I shudder when I remember this. The location seems solemn, but important. The ceremony is simple. Meredith and Franklin holding hands in front of the judge, exchanging rings and vows. I try to manage being a combination of witness, photographer, family of the bride, and maid of honor. I take out my digital camera and snap as many pictures as I can without feeling disruptive, knowing the rest of my family will want to see them. I do everything I can to be present, even if my mind is 381 miles away. To focus, I think of how dogs are witnesses, how they are present for our most private moments, how they are there when we think of ourselves as alone. They witness our quarrels, our tears, our struggles, our fears, and all of our secret behaviors that we have to hide from our fellow humans. They witness without judgment. There was a book once about a man who tried to teach his dog to speak a human language, to help him solve his wife's murder. It said that if dogs could tell us all they have seen, it would magically stitch together all the gaps in our lives. I try to witness this moment how a dog would witness it, to take it all in. For the rest of my family, this wedding will be a gap in their lives, and I need to do my best to fill it. The ceremony is perfect for my sister and her new husband. All business, no flourish. Nothing about the bride is property. No one to give her away. No mention of them being man and wife. No mention of a Christian God that none of us really believe in. They are both attorneys. The law is their church. When the judge unites them, he says, "By the power vested in me by the state of California, I recognize you as married." And just like that, as quickly as it began, the ceremony is over. I wander to the third floor with its peripheral balconies to take some photographs from above. Really, I need a moment to breathe. I want to call the animal hospital, but I don't. They won't do what I want them to do, which is to put Lily on the phone. In her drugged-out state on sedatives and painkillers, she won't talk much anyway. Below, Meredith and Franklin descend the central staircase, and I capture a lovely shot of them holding hands. I snap another of Jeffrey, leaning on a marble pillar looking relaxed and handsome. After the wedding, we head back to the Fairmont Hotel, and I excuse myself to the lobby bar. The same asshole is there, playing the same piano. I purchase a bottle of Veuve Clicquot from the bartender and get him to give me 6 glasses. We pop the champagne back in Meredith and Franklin's room, and I toast the newlyweds. And Meredith makes a round of phone calls to break the news to my family. They go down like this. Everyone is shocked. Everyone offers heartfelt congratulations. And after each call, she hands the phone to me, and then I get the brunt of it. "Did you know about this? How long did you know? Did you put her up to this? You didn't tell me? Why were you invited? Is she pregnant?" In everyone's shock, they forgot to ask about Lily. I just sip my champagne and roll with it as best I can. But inside, I'm wondering why on the day of my sister's union, more people aren't thinking about me. My mother is on the phone last. She's on the verge of tears. I can hear it in her voice. She would have liked to have been here. I think she's especially hurt that Franklin's parents were here in attendance. She doesn't see my having been the ambassador for our family as an adequate balance. And she's right. There is no one equal to a mother. "Meredith looks really happy," I say into the phone, trying to diffuse some of my mother's sadness. Should I have been more insistent with Meredith? "I wrote a check for $1,000 and put it in the mail," my mother says. But I'm not sure she's talking to me.
Excuse me?
For Lily's surgery. I'm sorry that I don't have more to contribute. Now it's me on the verge of tears.
You didn't have to.
I start, but I stop. It's an incredible gesture. And instead of protesting, I should just be grateful. Thank you. I think it comes out audibly. After the calls, I snap a few more pictures of the newlyweds in front of their enormous window. The top floor has a stunning vista of the city and the bay, and I frame them with Alcatraz far in the distance, just over my sister's shoulder. This is my silent statement about marriage. Or maybe about my own relationship with Jeffrey. When are you back? Afterward, we pile into cabs that race over the city's famed hills at enormously inappropriate speeds to Howard Street to dine at a restaurant called Town Hall, the perfect bookend with our earlier errand at City Hall. Town Hall is housed in a much simpler structure, brick instead of marble, red awnings instead of a dome. The sun has dipped below the sweeping hillsides and the air has turned cold. Inside, the exposed brick and modern chandeliers are warm and welcoming. I'm offered a seat between Jeffrey and Franklin's mother. I'm sorry about the way we're dressed. I was supposed to pick up our suits from the dry cleaners before we left, but my dog, Lily, had to have emergency surgery on her spine. We found her partially paralyzed, you see, and this will hopefully allow her to walk again, but it's too soon to tell if she actually will. I have no idea how much English Franklin's mother speaks, or if she's understanding any of this, so I grab the water glass in front of me and drink until it's empty. Eventually, my sister's new mother-in-law nods, and I take this as an invitation to continue. I'm really nervous. Scared, if I'm being honest. I'll never find another dog like her. She's so funny. The things she says sometimes, they just crack me up. She's really good with a joke. Franklin's mother blanches, and it's then that I wonder if she really understands more English than she lets on. Anyhow, tomorrow we can bring her home, and I worry if I'm up to the task of her care. I look down and fold the napkin in my lap a few different ways until I can't stretch the assignment any longer. Franklin's mother adds a quiet, woof, and offers me a warm smile. I think she understands my plight. It's a funny thing to worry about at a wedding dinner. Being up to the task. For richer, for poorer. In sickness and in health. I've never taken these vows before, nor do I know if I ever will. But I have felt them in other ways. I feel this duty with Lily, to stand with her in sickness until she is able to stand on her own four paws again. After dinner, Meredith, Franklin, Jeffrey, and I retire to the top of the Mark, a rooftop bar across California Street from our hotel. At night, the buildings around us twinkle like the night sky. In the distance, the Golden Gate Bridge is dappled with tiny shimmering headlights. Meredith pulls me aside to a quiet corner at the end of the bar.
Are you happy?
For you? I ask.
Of course.
I look across the room at Franklin, who was telling Jeffrey an animated tale.
No, are you happy?
I'm not sure how to answer her truthfully.
Why do you ask? I don't know. I've been watching you this weekend.
Meredith takes the cocktail menu from my hand and sets it down on the bar. I keep dwelling on this text message. I can't get it out of my mind.
From who?
From no one.
No one sent you a text message?
No one sent Jeffrey a text message. Meredith looks at me, frustrated.
This isn't the punchline to some family circus cartoon, is it?
I'll tell you some other time. I have to get through this thing with Lily first.
Lily will be fine. It's you I'm worried about.
Meredith puts a hand on my shoulder, but I don't say anything in response.
Don't use Lily as an excuse to ignore your own happiness.
I'm not, I protest.
Speak up for yourself.
I do.
No, you don't. We were raised the same, remember? I know you better than you think I do.
Oh, really? I say with a smirk. Did you know I was about to do this? I swiftly kick her in the shin. Payback. I hope no one sees and thinks she just married an abuser.
Ow! Actually, yes.
Meredith rubs her shin while looking up at me.
You have to communicate your needs to get them met. That's all I'm saying.
Bartender! Meredith sneers.
Not what I meant.
I know what you meant. We bring champagne to Franklin and Jeffrey, and I offer a final toast. Wishing you all good things in your life together. Short, simple, to the point. I look at Meredith, relaxed in her ivory gown. My sister is all grown up. I'm grateful we did our growing up together. When we get back to our room, this time it's me who changes our itinerary and books us two seats on the first morning flight out. There will be no lavish brunch with the newlyweds, only airport coffee and whatever they serve on the plane. If we're lucky, there will be a very quick goodbye before we sneak off to the airport. I crawl into bed and let the day wash over me. As exhausting as it's been, our San Francisco adventure, in many ways, has been a small oasis of calm. I think of myself floating on the barge that sails the Tongariro, swaying to Dan Fogelberg or Sheena Easton, or someone who in the parallel universe of the Hurricane Bar is still popular. I turn out the light. Darkness. The hard work of healing begins.
Squeezed. Squeeze, I say.
I am squeezing, Jeffrey replies.
Squeeze harder.
I'm squeezing as hard as I dare.
Well, you're not squeezing her right then.
Do you want to trade jobs because it's easy to just stand there and hold a flashlight?
Not the way you keep moving.
Jeffrey gets annoyed and he lets go. He stands up and hits his head on the outcropped tree branch above him. Look out for that branch, I say, completely unhelpfully. I know this will enrage him, but I feel entitled to say what I want, because I'm scared. I hand Jeffrey the flashlight and crouch down next to Lily, who cowers on the gravel in the harsh puddle of light. I place my hands, as the vet instructed, on either side of her under the abdomen, and I squeeze her soft bladder. In and back, in and back. Nothing. The light glints off the staples that run the length of her back. She's laced up like a football.
Anything?
Jeffrey asks. I tip her up and look underneath for evidence that she has peed. Nothing. I run through the steps again. The doctor said it feels like a water balloon?
Yes, like a water balloon, about the size of a small lemon.
Lily's abdomen does feel like a water balloon, soft and squishy. Expressing her bladder was not something I had steeled myself for on the flight back from San Francisco. I thought I had prepared mentally as well as I could. I drank coffee instead of liquor. I stayed awake instead of sleeping. I made a shopping list for all the things we would need on the back of a napkin. A pen to keep her quarantined to a small area. Blankets so she wouldn't slip on the hardwood floors. Toys that would keep her mentally engaged without exciting her physically. Treats, healthy ones, so that she wouldn't gain weight during the inactivity of recovery. Carrying added pounds would just be additional stress on her spine. Learning to express a dog's bladder, however, was not on that list, despite how obvious it seems to me now. The vet who discharged us laid down a wee-wee pad on the cold metal examining table and showed us just how it was done. She made it seem so effortless. I assumed I had understood the lesson. Turns out I was wrong. We haven't been able to get her to pee since we left the hospital.
My poor girl. The indignity of it all. I hoist Lily in the football carry that was demonstrated for us, supporting her hindquarters carefully to avoid the tree branch above. Let's go to bed. Frustrated, Jeffrey switches off the flashlight. I know this means she may release her bladder in her sleep in our bed, but we'll just have to get up and change the sheets. There's no squeezing her any harder. Inside, I set her down on a blanket, and she stands upright. I'm amazed by this progress, even though she can't yet walk. She can stand, unsteady though she is, and that in itself is a huge accomplishment. For now, that's enough. I read the instructions again on Lily's red prescription bottles and select a tramadol for pain and a clavamox to ward off infection and seal them into a pill pocket. She gobbles up the treat.
Monkey, look at you. You're standing.
My name is Lily.
I know it is. I rest my hand on the top of her head and her eyes blink heavily. She is only 7, but for the first time, she looks old. A strip of bare skin runs down her back where the staples are. She looks sad, disrobed of her mahogany fur.
What happened to you?
Lily seems to concentrate on remembering.
I don't know. I woke up, and I couldn't walk.
You scared me.
I cup her head in my hands, and she looks like a nun in a wimple. She licks her chops for any remaining flavor from the pill pocket.
I know you put medicine in those things.
I know you know.
Then I add, the medicine will help you heal. Lily considers this.
Can I have my red ball?
I gently lift her up and study her Frankenstein scar. It's like she's now assembled from 2 different dogs, the puppy who will always want to play, and the senior dog, who must come to understand her limits. I make her a promise.
Soon.
I place Lily gently on a layer of towels on her bed, nestled safely between Jeffrey and me, and the pain pill and the toll of the day knock her out within minutes. Sleep comes fast for me as well. It's almost impossible to believe that when I woke up this morning, I was in San Francisco. I dream of the beach where Lily would run off season, when she was a puppy. In my dream, she runs and runs, not getting anywhere fast. There are other dogs, bigger dogs, and she wants to run near them, but not with them. She's slightly intimidated by their size and the sand they kick up with their paws. Her whole body is a compression spring that launches her with each step into momentary levitation. Her floppy ears bound upward with each gallop, sometimes floating there in the wind as if someone has put them on pause. When she comes back to me, I know they will be flipped backward, pinned to her head and the back of her neck. I spend half my life restoring that dog's ears to their factory setting.
The sand is so squishy under my paws! And look how vast the ocean! Watch me run without my leash.
Before she can say leash, a wave sweeps in and engulfs her delicate paws in a strand of slick seaweed, and a look of terror washes over her face.
Serpent! Serpent! Serpent!
She turns and hightails it to drier sand, closer to the dunes where the last of the tall grass waves. Immediately, her nose picks up the scent of a dead crab. She rips off a leg and runs with it in her mouth off into the distance until she is no more than a speck on the horizon. In the morning, Jeffrey and I dress quickly and immediately take Lily outside. We set her on the grass, and again she is able to stand. She even attempts an excited step or two, looking not unlike Bambi but with shorter legs, before I can calm her to keep her from overexerting herself.
Shh.
Jeffrey looks to intervene, but I shrug him off. This is my job. This is my moment. I will not be a coward. I will not be afraid. I will not be someone who can love only so much. I will not be someone who is not whole or fully present when things get tough. I will not let others do the heavy lifting for me.
I will not be distracted by a text message. Wringing the piss out of this dog I love. This is my Everest. This is on me. I tuck Lily's hind legs under her and settle her into her usual crouch, legs slightly splayed like a frog's. From behind her, I reach under her abdomen and feel for the water balloon, for the soft squish the size of a lemon. When I find it, I take a deep breath, gird myself, and squeeze. Up and to the back. I don't know what's different in the morning light. The fullness of her bladder, her willingness to do her part, my fearlessness brought on by the dawn of a new day, the dream of her running, the desire to see her run again. Whatever it is, when I squeeze up and to the back, her tail rises to that familiar 45-degree angle that makes it look like a missile about to launch, and slowly, she starts to pee.
She's doing it! You're doing it!
I'm so excited I almost let go, but I don't. I continue to squeeze. Lily is startled by the sensation and overwhelmed with relief. Jeffrey pumps his fist, and we both break out in smiles. At last, Jeffrey says, relieved.
Ha ha!
I am triumphant. Lily attempts to stand, and I realize I can't stop squeezing. I gently guide her over the puddle of her making.
You did it, Bean.
Everything else fades away. I'm the happiest I have ever been. Suction. Monday. The octopus sits in his usual perch as Lily and I make our way to the veterinarian's office. We skirt the construction around LACMA because no one in Los Angeles knows how to merge. Lily sits as she always does when I drive, in my lap with her chin nestled in the crook of my left elbow, the arm I try in vain to steer with as I downshift with my right. She looks up at me, annoyed whenever we actually have to make a turn. The octopus hasn't said anything this morning. He doesn't have to. The echo of his voice rings hauntingly in my brain. He's getting bigger by the hour. The waiting room is small and dark and cramped. The brown linoleum floor is peeling in the corners, and any available breathing room is filled with shelves of dietary pet food and supplements with names like Rimadyl and Glycoflex. I'm not sure why I still go to this vet, other than that it's close to my house. This is a pattern in my life I need to rethink. Jenny the therapist, this dumpy veterinary office. I will say there are new doctors here who are better than the last rotation, who disappeared suddenly after some unflattering Yelp reviews. I find a seat on an empty bench made of wood and wrought iron. It makes me feel like I'm waiting for a trolley. The shelves tower over us, which would be our doom in an earthquake, but also mercifully provide at least the illusion of privacy. Veterinary offices can be a grab bag of emotions. Cats are always frightened and in crates, their owners equally skittish. There are happy dogs here for simple things like checkups, excited to be out in the world and scenting the lingering promise of a biscuit. There are nervous dogs who hate the vet under any circumstance. There are sick and injured dogs with fretful owners who may bark and lunge and bite. There are owners leaving with no pets, having just received some kind of devastating news. And then there's us. People with dogs with octopuses on their heads. We, apparently, are the worst of the lot, since we are too horrific and deformed to look at. Others who pass through give us a wide berth. After some time, we are led into an examining room to wait for the doctor. I set Lily down on the table, and she flinches as her pads make contact with the cold metal. I stroke her back to get her to stay calm. This room is also small. On the wall is a poster promoting pet dental care with photos of dog teeth in varying stages of decay. The wallpaper, somewhat ironically, is the color of gum disease. The vet enters with a smile. He's the cutest of the newer staff, and I've named him Doogie in my head because he looks too young to be a doctor, even an animal doctor, which may or may not, who really knows, require fewer years in school. His khakis have pleats, and I wonder if I should mention something about how outdated they look. But maybe he wears them in an attempt to look older.
What brings you in today?
Flabbergasted, I stare at him square in the eye. If he was reading a chart or looking at notes from Lily's patient file, that would be one thing. But he's looking right at my dog, with that grin. This is probably where his inexperience cuts against him. Are you serious? It's all I can stammer.
How is Lily?
He pulls back her lips and stares at her teeth. What's he getting at? I know they are old. I know they're rotting. I know both her teeth and her gums are victims of my tight budget and neglect. But are they worse than what's on her head? Is that really what he's saying? What is the obsession in this place with teeth? Well, for starters, she has an octopus on her head. The vet lets go of her jaw, looks at Lily's head, and blanches.
Oh.
Yes. Oh. The vet crouches down to get a better view of the octopus.
How long has that been there?
I first noticed him late last week. He grabs Lily by the snout and angles her head around to get a good look at it from all sides.
And an octopus, you're calling it.
What would you call it? I begin to scan the room to see if there is a framed veterinary degree of some kind on the wall that might inspire confidence. I remember internet stalking Doogie after our last visit because I thought he was handsome. I think he went to school in Pennsylvania, but now I'm not so sure. The pants, his cluelessness. Maybe he just purchased a degree from a fake school in Guam. I won't be internet stalking him again. Doogie doesn't break his study of the octopus. He touches it, taps it, and then reaches for a few gauze squares and tries to squeeze it.
Octopus is as good a word as any.
His tone suggests that he's trying to keep me calm. Careful, I tell him. You're going to make him angry. He gets his hands fully around the octopus.
I'd say he's already pretty angry.
Doogie stands up, steps on a lever to open the lid of a covered metal garbage can marked medical waste, and tosses the gauze away. Well, what are we going to do about it?
First, we need to know more. I'd like to take Lily into the back and see if I can't get a needle into it and extract some fluid. Then we can run some tests to see what we're dealing with.
Lily looks up at me, annoyed as I am. This makes me lose my patience.
We're dealing with an octopus.
I'm red in the face, and I can feel sweat forming on my back even though I don't want to be this worked up. So help me God if he wants to look at the octopus's teeth.
I know that. But the more we know about the octopus, the more we will know how to fight him.
This is the first reasonable thing he has said, so I crouch down speaking directly to Lily.
Go with the doctor. He's going to get a better look at the octopus. I'll be right out here.
Doogie collects a veterinary assistant, and they whisk Lily away. Back in the waiting room, I flip through an old copy of Dog Fancy magazine. There are articles like Five Mutts Who Rose to Fame and Spotlight on the English Springer Spaniel. These don't interest me. But Dental Debate Erupts Over Teeth Cleaning does, at least enough to dog-ear the page and hopefully catch the attention of at least one rational thinker in this godforsaken place. I pull out my phone and go to my photo archive to look at pictures of Lily before the octopus came. She and I on a cliff overlooking Santa Barbara that one time we took a drive up the Pacific Coast Highway. Her asleep on her paw print blanket, the sun from the window highlighting the red in her brown coat. Her in the bathtub, wet and annoyed. The two of us in a selfie exchanging goodnight kisses in bed before sleep. Her on the sofa, sitting like the Great Sphinx of Giza. Because I liked the way her coat looked against the gray tweed upholstery. Another selfie. This time we're in the backyard and she's wearing a lei I got her on Maui. This one is only a few weeks old. A happier time, already long ago. Something in the picture catches my eye. I use two fingers to zoom in on the photo until I'm focused on her right temple. And there he is, in his usual perch just above her right eye. The octopus. But smaller. Younger. Less pronounced. How could I have not seen him then? Did he come back with me from Hawaii? Catch a ride in that lei? Did I somehow pick him up from the beach that day when I walked with Wendy and Harlan and Jill collecting sea glass? Or when I was swimming in the ocean, my guard down, my cares floating away? Did I bring this upon us by needing to get away with my friends? Or did he crawl out of the Pacific at Santa Monica Beach while I was not there to stop him, attach himself to my dog while I was on an island sipping rum thousands of miles away? I'm awash in horrible stomach-churning feelings of guilt. It was just 5 nights in Hawaii. How could that come with so huge a cost?
Excuse me, hon.
The large woman who answers the phone is trying to retrieve a few cans of diabetic dog food from the shelf near my feet. I sit up in the chair and swing my legs in the other direction. She grunts as she bends down to get them. I put my phone away and turn my attention back to dog fancy, but I don't even get into the debate over teeth cleaning before Doogie calls my name.
Edward?
When I get back to the examining room, Lily is there on the table waiting for me. She looks pained. How did it go?
We weren't able to get a needle as deeply into the octopus as I would have liked.
He's a tough son of a bitch, I concede.
We were able to extract a few cells, hopefully enough to tell us if the octopus is malignant. We'll have to send them out to our lab.
I show Doogie the picture of Lily in her lei, with the octopus in its infancy. I tell him about the octopus as I know him, about the seizure Lily had last night. He nods and listens, and makes a few notes on his chart. Lily doesn't add anything, but that's not unusual. She often clams up at the vet.
Once we get the report back from the lab, we'll know more. We can try her on certain medications, an anti-seizure medication for one, but, you know, our best options for dealing with the
octopus. Why is everyone so stupid?
Octopus are probably surgical.
I look away, purposefully. It would help if there were a window to gaze out of. Instead, I'm confronted with a dental care poster again. I think of the dog-eared copy of Dog Fancy in the waiting room and hope to God someone who works there finds it.
How old is Lily again?
The vet flips through her chart for the answer. 12, I say. And a half. He puts the chart down.
That's older than optimal for invasive surgery. The anesthesia alone can be a risk for older dogs. But we can discuss our options in more detail midweek.
When you hear back from the lab. I sound defeated. I feel defeated. Especially when I'm asked to pay $285 for the privilege of being told to wait until Wednesday to be given options that aren't really options at all. We get in the car and someone signals their blinker from my parking spot, but I emphatically wave them away like they're after my soul and not just my parking spot. And so we sit there for 12 minutes until the meter runs out. Lily silently crawls from the passenger seat into my lap and curls up in a little ball. She lets out an enormous sigh.
You okay, Bean? They put a needle in my head.
They put a needle in the octopus. Lily looks at me as if they're one and the same, and I wonder if she's already giving up hope. I feel like I've swallowed my own bag of wasabi peas as my throat starts to burn and then close. I try to focus on something, anything, and I choose the spelling of wasabi, and how odd it is that I can't remember if it ends with an I-E or just an I. I think it's just an I. Can that be right? Both ways I can see a squiggly red line underneath it, like the word processor in my brain is telling me there's no correct way to spell it. Is wasabi a proper noun? Should it be capitalized? No, it's just a plant, isn't it? I want to run back inside the veterinary office and have them do for me what they did for Lily all those years ago. Give me back my ability to breathe. and maybe confirm the spelling of wasabi. I can't remember the last time I've taken a breath, a long, deep, true breath, the kind they talk about in Lamaze classes and on yoga DVDs. Hawaii, I guess. Vacation. When I was free of work and deadlines and dating and the need for anything else but to just be. But the last time at home? Without my ties easing my circulation? I can't say. I feel a sudden need to forget the morning. To turn the day around. To vomit the wasabi peas. To breathe again. You know what we need? I ask. I don't even wait for her to guess. Lily perks up. She can tell by the tone of my voice I'm going to say something that she finds exciting. Ice cream. On the way home, we stop at the corner pet store near our house, the one the Korean family runs, and I select a peanut butter frozen yogurt made especially for dogs. I don't even wait for us to get home. The octopus blinks and asks, "What you got there?" I don't think I'll ever get used to hearing him speak. "Nothing," is my reply. I hold the styrofoam dish for Lily right there in the car, and she laps at it hungrily until the frozen treat is gone. Even then, she licks the empty dish for another 3 minutes, her mood brightened. The octopus eyes me hungrily the whole time, but I don't let him have any. I hope not to pay dearly for that later. Tuesday. Lily and I have no standing plans on Tuesday nights, so when Trent calls and says we should go grab a drink by the beach, I agree. It's night, and I immediately have second thoughts. It feels like a hassle to go all the way to the beach this late when you can't even see the beach. But Trent is already down there for a business dinner that's just ending. And the beach always seems like a getaway, a respite, a destination. Even in darkness, you can smell the salt water, hear the crashing waves, feel the cool ocean breeze. These used to be a comfort. Now, the ocean is mostly the swamp the octopus crawled out of. Trent wants to know what the vet said about Lily's prognosis, and since I don't have Jenny until Friday, it's probably a good idea for me to talk. Trent is feeling nostalgic and suggests this gay bar we went to in the 90s that's right across the Pacific Coast Highway from Will Rogers Beach. Specifically, the gay section of Will Rogers Beach, known affectionately as Ginger Rogers. Parking is usually a nightmare, but I luck out and find the perfect spot under a broken street lamp, hidden from drivers in a pool of gloom. It's maddeningly too small, and after 5 minutes of trying to fit in the damn thing, I have to concede defeat and move on to the next spot I find a good quarter mile away. On my hike back to the bar, I step in a puddle. It hasn't rained in weeks, so that's of some concern. I try to text Trent, but my phone is frozen, and I have to give it a hard reboot. When I finally make it to the bar, the exterior looks different. It has a nautical theme like I remember, but something is amiss. I guess the bar could look at my haggard face and say the same about me. The place is dimly lit, but it's easy to spot Trent sitting at the bar. He's one of the few people here. I pull back the stool next to him, wave for the bartender, and take a seat. "What made you think of this place?" I ask. "Client dinner. The fog of work. Remembering simpler times." The bartender comes over, and he's good-looking, but not the threatening kind of good-looking that's usually a job requirement for bartenders in gay bars. I ask Trent what he's drinking, and he says vodka tonic, so I order the same. "What did the vet say?" Trent asks. "What are the options?" The bartender pushes the drink in my direction at the last second, adding a lime. I reach for my wallet before Trent stops me. I opened a tab. I take a sip of the drink, and it's strong, which I like. They can either make her comfortable with medications to stop any pain and seizures, or they can put her under, take a bigger sample of the octopus, and devise a more aggressive treatment plan. "What are you going to choose?" I shrug and take another sip of my drink. "I don't know. I have to talk it over with Lily." "It's your decision, though." "Is it?" I look around the deserted bar. Where is everyone? Trent turns around and flinches, like it's the first time he's noticing the emptiness. Don't know. Guess it's a later crowd. The bartender must be eavesdropping because he chimes in.
It picks up after 11.
I take out my phone to check the time, but it's not rebooting, and I plunk it down on the bar. Great. Fucking Tuesdays. What's wrong with Tuesdays? Trent asks. Everything. Monday's always Monday, but at least it's the start of something new. Wednesday is hump day, Thursday's almost Friday, and Friday brings the weekend. But Tuesday? Nada. Trent looks at me and shakes his head. What difference does it make? You work at home. I work from home, I say. But I don't know why it makes a difference to me. My phone is fried. My parking spot was too small. I stepped in. I looked down at my shoe. Urine. I don't know what to do about Lily. Should I go on? Trent puts his hand on my shoulder. We need to get you laid. He surveys the room again, but the prospects are dim. Oh, I got laid. When? I reach for my phone to check today's date before remembering it's dead. I don't remember. Recently. I guess there's life in me still. Recently? He sounds skeptical. Yes, recently. And then I'm forced to concede. I think it was recently. Time runs together. Well, we need to get you laid again. At least some uncommitted lip. That's what he calls casual kissing. Maybe after 11. Why did I have such a distaste for Tuesdays now that I freelance from home? Trent has a point. If I hated Tuesdays for their sameness when I was part of the world, a member of a more traditional workforce, their lack of anything to help them stand apart, wouldn't it make sense that I hate everything now? Every morning I rise at 8. It takes a little effort to wake Lily, but not much. I throw on some clothes, usually something that I can wear to the gym as a motivator to go. We head outside for the first of the day's walks. The morning sun feels just right, not too hot or oppressive. I know this in part because Lily only starts to pant when we round the corner in front of our house, and the panting goes away after she has just a few sips of water. I give Lily her breakfast, and I have one, always one, cup of coffee, sweetened with stevia. I bring my laptop from my desk where it has charged overnight and sit in the kitchen in the spot where the glare from the window misses the screen. I write for an hour or maybe two and then have a bowl of kashi covered with half of a sliced banana. The other half goes in the fridge. Then I allow myself the day's procrastination. I read the news. I argue with dumb people on websites. I stalk random crushes online. Sometimes I actually make it to the gym. Lately, not as often. In the afternoons, I try to get out of the house, but even then the errands and the distractions have a sameness to them. Groceries for the night's meal, coffee on Larchmont, a movie at the Arclight I don't particularly want to see. I get in the car, I park the car, I get out of the car. The driving, the destination, I don't always remember. Lily and I take a second walk. An evening walk where we enjoy the soft haze in the sky, except at the height of summer when it is still quite bright, or the turn of the winter solstice when it is already dark. Lily gets dinner and a rawhide chew. I have a glass of wine and something to chew on myself, usually dried mango or apricot, but the unsulfured kind that doesn't give me headaches. I write for a spell. It's only the evening activities with Lily, game nights and movie nights and pizza that provide a small respite from the monotony. At night, I put my laptop back on my desk and my phone back on its charger. Lily and I go out one last time. I never set an alarm before bed. I don't have to. My insides are as tuned in to the sameness as my everything else. Someone has taken a seat on the bar stool next to Trent, and the two of them are talking. Trent gestures back at me. The guy leans in to see past Trent, looks at me, then holds his hand up as if to say, "Not interested." Trent turns back to me and shrugs. "Who did you hook up with?" It's an obvious attempt to keep the conversation on my successes. Massage guy, the one who came to my house. Theodore, Trent says disapprovingly. He calls me Theodore instead of Edward when he wants to full name me because he knows it gets under my skin. Not my name. Isn't that like paying for it? No, I say with four or five O's, partly in defense of my reputation and partly in defense of massage guys. I paid for a massage. Then we got to talking. I offered him a drink. We each had a few while we continued our conversation. He's a writer, too, a librettist. Libidinous? No. Well, that, too. A librettist. He writes the words for... The point is, we had a surprising amount in common, so we talked for a while. And then... I let the sentence finish itself. It was like a date. Except, you know, I was wearing a towel. Trent laughs. I should have seen that one coming. It took me by surprise. But maybe I should have seen it coming, too. At least an indication it might happen. An omen. My eyes are too often closed to these things. Should I have seen it coming? Should I have seen the octopus coming? An omen for that? Octo. Latin for eight. But who did I know who was Latin? Any number of people. This is Los Angeles, after all. Maybe the Latin origin is the wrong thing to focus on. Maybe it's the eight itself. The bartender pours a beer. There are 8 pints in a gallon. 8 crayons in a box of Crayolas. 8 nights of Hanukkah. 8 atoms of something in octane. Carbon? Compounds of carbon form the basis of all life. Could that be it? A stop sign has 8 sides. Is the octopus a sign for me to stop? And if so, stop what? But can't omens be good as well as bad? If there was an omen of the octopus coming and I missed it, shouldn't I be looking for an omen of recovery? An omen of the octopus leaving? Omen is also Latin. Back to that again. My brain hurts. What time is it? I ask. Trent checks his phone. 11:15. As if on cue, the door opens and a few people enter, laughing. They're all wearing black pants and white shirts. I elbow Trent, who just mouths, weird, studies the late arrivals, and lands on one guy with a pen stuck behind his ear. What about that one? He's still focused on my getting some uncommitted lip. I flag down the bartender. Another round? He asks. Can I ask you a really stupid question? Shoot, he says. Isn't this a gay bar? The bartender laughs. Used to be. The owner sold it. Now it's mostly a hangout for local restaurant servers when their shifts end. That's why it picks up late. I look at Trent, who just shrugs. My head hits the bar, and I speak into the crook of my arm. We're really bad at this, I say. I blame you. You've been happy too long. I blame you. You've been unhappy too long. Trent fixes his gaze on the blank space above me. What are you doing? Looking for the black cloud over your head. He punches me playfully. I punch him back, a little less playfully. One more round, Trent says to the bartender, who places 2 fresh cocktail napkins on the bar before retreating to make our drinks. Friday. How was your week? It's Friday again, which means I'm back in Jenny's butter office, having scant recollections of Wednesday or Thursday. There was another seizure. Not as bad as the first, but still scary. There was a call from the vet, but they were not able to extract enough cells from the octopus to find anything conclusive. Doogie wants to put her under general anesthesia to collect a larger sample. There was supposed to be another date with the hugging guy, but I canceled, since I was feeling gross and unattractive and unworthy of being loved. Ironically, this will probably help him clarify his feelings.
Men are hunters, and tend to like other men who don't make it easy. Mostly this week I withdrew. Withdrawing, however, is difficult in therapy, even therapy with Jenny. It's especially hard today, as Jenny sits